You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1998 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the fourth class in a series given by Brother George Booker, titled, The Story of Ruth.
Good morning, everyone. We'll begin by reading Ruth chapter 2, verse 18, just to pick up the story where we left off before. So she carried the grain back to town, and her mother-in-law, Naomi, saw how much she had gathered. Ruth also brought out and gave her what she had left over after she had eaten enough. Her mother-in-law asked her, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she had been working. "The name of the man I worked with today is Boaz," she said. "The Lord bless him," Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. "He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead." She added, "That man is our close relative. He is one of our kinsmen redeemers." Now through her daughter-in-law Ruth, Naomi once again sees that God's providence is there and at work. There is a near kinsman, not a brother of Ruth's dead husband, but a near kinsman, a cousin perhaps, one who can marry Ruth, one who can care for Naomi, one who can raise up seed for the family line that is in danger of disappearing out of Israel. This Hebrew word is something like ga'al, and it means literally a relative. But by common usage, as it occurs in the Old Testament, it also means a redeemer, one who buys back, one who puts together that which has been separated, one who finds that which has been lost and brings it back again. And so quite often you'll see it translated in your Bibles as the Redeemer and sometimes the Kinsman Redeemer, putting together the two ideas, the literal meaning of the word and then the usage of the word as it seems to occur many times in Scripture. And this, of course, reminds us of Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 through 10 that we read, I think it was the first day of class. But there are other laws that have to do with the duty of the kinsman, the duty of the near relative to help the family, to keep the family together. We're going to look at a couple of those briefly to set the stage for what follows. First of all, Leviticus chapter 25, and we'll start with verse 23. One of the important things to the people of Israel was the very land on which they stood and lived and worked, where they planted their crops, where they built their homes. This was God's land, but God had charitably consented to share this land with a people who were his people. And we know through the history of Israel, as long as they, as a nation, were faithful, more or less, they remained in the land. But when they proved to be unfaithful collectively, God drove them from the land because it was his land. It wasn't really theirs. But in keeping with this sense of the land belonging to God, we read some of the passage here in Leviticus 25, beginning with verse 23. "The land must not be sold permanently because the land is mine and you are but aliens and my tenants," God says to Israel. "Throughout the country that you hold as a possession, you must provide for the redemption of the land. If one of your countrymen becomes poor and sells some of his property, the family inheritance, his nearest relative," that's the kinsman redeemer, as we were talking about a moment ago, "is to come and redeem or buy back what his countryman, what his relative has sold. If, however, a man has no one to redeem it for him, but he himself prospers and acquires sufficient means to redeem it or to buy it back, then he is to determine the value of the year since he sold it and refund the balance and, in effect, you know, take the mortgage back and hold that land again. The first thing the man should do is buy back that property. That property is the most important thing. Verse 28, "But if he does not acquire the means to repay him and get that property back into the possession of his family, what he sold will remain in the possession of the buyer until the year of Jubilee, and it will be returned in the year of Jubilee." Now, this was mentioned also back in verses 9 and 10, so let's look at that as well. Leviticus 25, verses 9 and 10. Then have the trumpet sounded everywhere on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement. Sound the trumpet throughout your land. Consecrate the 50th year. That would be the year of Jubilee in the calendar of Israel. Seven sevens and then the 50th year. Consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you. The blowing of a trumpet is the meaning of the word. Each one of you is to return to his family property and each to his own clan. So, in the course of daily life, year after year, a man in Israel or a family in Israel might be separated from their land. This would certainly be the last thing that they would want to sell, but they might sell it. And God's law is very explicit. Bring that land back into the family. And if the individual who sold it through financial circumstances is unable to buy it back, then a near relative should do that for him. It is terribly important that the family and the land be together, because God has promised this land collectively and then individually as an inheritance for his people. So he's always intent on bringing the people back to their land. Now, another passage, we're in Leviticus 25. Let's look at another aspect of what the kinsman redeemer might do. Leviticus 25, beginning with verse 47, and that's on the board too. If an alien or a temporary resident among you becomes rich, and one of your countrymen becomes poor and sells himself to the alien living among you or to a member of the alien's clan, sells his services, some kind of contract, not quite of slavery, but you might say of indentured servitude, sells himself to this alien or another resident of the land, he retains the right of redemption after he has sold himself. One of his relatives may redeem him. We're back to the duties of the kinsman redeemer. Someone has become very poor. The only way he can pay off his debts is to sell himself into servitude and get some kind of advance payment, perhaps, by which the debts can be paid off. And then he continues to work in that servitude, and he may work in that indentured service for some years. But if possible, he is to buy himself out of that service by keeping money to the side. If he's unable to do it, a relative of his should do this. And then, once again, as we come to the end of that section, we are told that at the year of Jubilee, the 50th year, if he has been unable to buy himself out of service, then God frees him, and once again he goes out to be free. So, once again, if there is to be found no human kinsman redeemer who can buy a person out of slavery, then God says that person will be freed no later than the 50th year, or his descendants, if in fact he has indentured them into service as well. Now, there's another couple of Bible passages that talk about service for 6 years and being free in the 7th year, and there may be a minor distinction between the two as to the kind of service. The one may have been more of a slavery, whereas the other is more of an indentured service. But in either case, what God is saying is, if you have given up your liberty, if you've been forced to give up your liberty, strive to be free again, and strive to make your brother free. And if even you are unable to do this for yourselves, I will step in and see that you're made free again. And then we come to the other aspect of the kinsman redeemer, having to do with the family, having to do with the preservation of the family. Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 to 10. We looked at this, so we'll just turn to it quickly once again, and maybe you'll be reminded of the essence of this passage. If brothers are living together and one of them dies without a son, his widow must not marry outside the family. Her husband's brother... And perhaps this is expanded in the sense that brother can mean any near relative, is to do the part of the dead husband, is to marry the woman and raise up a seed so that the family line will be preserved in Israel. So you put all these things together in the mix and you see what's happening. God is concerned about the individual having liberty, not being in bondage to serve another man. And of course, this has echoes in the New Testament, being in bondage to serve sin, and we have been made free. We are made at liberty so that we can serve Christ. So the man was to be free, His family was to be free. He was to retain a possession of the land because God had given the land to him. The man and his family and the land were to be kept together. And this was to be true generation after generation. If a family was in danger of dying out because the husband had died and there were no seed, then the brother or the near kinsman was to step in and make sure that that family line continued. God was intensely interested in every family retaining its identity generation after generation so that there would be this inheritance of the land. And all of these things are fundamental in a sense for the promises that have been given to us. When God gives promises to Abraham, it has to do with his family being blessed generation after generation and one coming in the future who will see that all of these previous generations and all people of other nations who would join themselves to Israel would be blessed. And that blessing includes freedom from sin and bondage, and it includes the possession of a specific land, the Holy Land, God's land, and it was always his land. But he gives it graciously to those who are his family, to those who say, you are our God and we wish to be your people. This is what is happening here. It's just a little subtext of the story of Ruth, the preservation of the family, the preservation of the land, the preservation of the lineage of the family, generation after generation. So, as we concluded yesterday, time had passed as much as 2 months while Ruth was gleaning in the fields day after day, waiting to see what would happen next, doing her labor and watching and waiting for the salvation of the Lord. And so we hear from Ruth again.
While I was in the fields, I could let my mind wander to the past, and sometimes I even smiled at the thought of a future. Would I always be one of the poor? A gleaner, always? Would I someday remarry? There were even times when I longed for a home of my own, with a loving husband, and yes, I even dared to dream again of little ones. And then I would dismiss my daydreams with the thoughts that all things were in my Heavenly Father's capable hands, and He would provide for me and all my concerns in due time. For now, there was work to be done by me. Thus, it was quite a shock when one evening Naomi said to me, "My daughter, should I not try to find a home for you, where you will be well provided for?" I sat staring at her. My mind was a whirl of confusion. She was speaking. She was speaking of marriage for me. And not just to someone I did not know, but of marriage to Boaz, our wealthy relative, the man for whom I gleaned. She continued, "Tonight he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Wash and perfume yourself and put on your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you are there until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he is lying. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do." I heard my own voice replying, "I will do whatever you say." I had learned that the law provided for a brother or next of kin to take his relative's widow as his wife. I learned, too, that the firstborn of such a marriage would be in memory of the deceased, with all legal rights and properties belonging to that child. I wasn't sure I was ready for all this. True, I had thought of remarrying someday, but this was so sudden, so unusual. What would Boaz think of such a forward young woman? What if servants discovered me with Boaz? Would he, like others, see me as a Moabite to be shunned forever? How was I to say the words? The thoughts tumbled together in my mind and remained so as I followed Naomi's instructions. She was my mother-in-law, my parent, and I dutifully obeyed her. She had my well-being always in her mind. My physical and spiritual concerns were hers. Prayer after prayer went through my confused mind. This God of Israel had looked after me for some time now. I had to leave it all to him. There was no turning back.
Let's look at a couple of Bible passages in the book of Ruth. In Ruth chapter 1, verse 9, even as Naomi was leaving the land of Moab with her two daughters-in-law, she says to them, "May the Lord," verse 9, "May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." Notice the word rest there. I'm reading from the NIV. In chapter 2, verse 12, and we looked at this yesterday, Boaz commends Ruth because she has come to the land of Israel, to the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. This sheltering under the wings, or under the arms, as we stated yesterday, of God. And now, Naomi has taken a further step in her thinking, and she relays it to Ruth. Chapter 3, verse 1, Naomi says to her, "My daughter, should I not try to find a home for you?" And the margin, I believe, in some versions says, "a place of rest." Now, does anyone know the Hebrew word that is translated here, home, or place of rest? You've been using it all through the week and you didn't know it. At least some of you, I suppose. You knew more Hebrew than you thought. It's the word menucha, the place of stillness and rest, the place of refuge. And in this sense, the place where a woman can find a home and security with a husband who loves her and cares for her under the overshadowing arms of God, within God's land and within God's covenant. This is what Naomi is saying. We should find for you a menucha, a place of rest. Naomi is suggesting that Ruth may find a husband under whose arms she may have rest. In Matthew chapter 11, Jesus, and I think he must have stretched out his arms when he said this, said to those who were listening, "Come unto me, you who labor and are heavy laden." We think of the laboring of Ruth and the gleaning. "And I will give you rest." In effect, he was saying, "You will find shelter under my arms. My yoke is easy. My burden is light. You will find rest for your lives, for your hearts, for your souls." In verse 2, Naomi points out that there would be winnowing of grain. This was the time of harvest. There would be winnowing of grain in the threshing floor. And men would be working late there, and they would be even resting and staying close to their winnowed grain so as to protect it, because there was always the possibility of someone stealing the grain. Winnowing was done quite often on a moonlit night because there would be a strong breeze blowing. The land was quite close to the sea, and at night winds would blow from the sea. Using a large shovel called a fan or a winnowing fork, the threshed mixture of grain and chaff would be thrown up into the wind. Now, I used to think when I read such passages of the winnowing of the wheat from the chaff that this is what happened, that the mixture would be thrown up in the air, and then, of course, the grain would fall back to the ground, being quite heavy, and the chaff being much lighter. It had been crushed and mixed, and now it could be separated from the grain, and the chaff would just blow away and would disappear. But I read a couple of commentaries, and I realized that's kind of a short-sighted view of how these things would have happened, because assuming that the breeze was blowing consistently from one direction, more or less, then the winnower would take this fork or this shovel and would throw the mixture up into the air, And then, of course, the grain would be rather heavy, so it would fall to the ground fairly close to where he was standing. First part, as I stated, would be correct. But the chaff would be somewhat lighter generally. It wouldn't be blown in every direction. The chaff would be blown a bit further, so that when the process was finished for some mound of grain and chaff that were being winnowed, there would be one sizable pile of grain and then another pile a bit further along of the chaff. And there would be a distinct separation. Now maybe it depends on how carefully this was done, and maybe it would be done more than once, but there would be a very distinct separation into two camps or two piles of the grain on the one hand, which was to be preserved and kept, and the chaff. And a couple of passages then follow up on this and say the chaff would now be gathered together and burned in the fire so as to be destroyed. So the chaff wouldn't necessarily blow away and disappear like grass maybe when you mow your lawn and it just kind of disappears eventually and you don't really know where it went. But the chaff is also collectively in a pile, and then that pile has to be disposed of. And when you think of it that way, as it must have worked generally, then we have a very precise picture of judgment, the separation of the wheat from the chaff, and each pile has its separate fate. So just an incidental point as we go along. In verse 3, as we heard in the story, Naomi says to Ruth, "Wash yourself, use the best perfumes, and put on your best clothes." There are several Bible passages on the board here. We won't look them up. They have to do with the preparation of a bride for her husband. Psalm 45 is a psalm of marriage, the bride and the bridegroom. And the bride puts on her best garments and is perfumed and prepared for her husband. And Deuteronomy 21 is a passage talking about the foreign woman who is to be incorporated into the camp of Israel, and the washing and the changing of clothes that is a part of that ritual. And then we come to, and we could look at a half dozen passages, but I just mentioned one, Ephesians chapter 4, verses 22 through 24, that speaks of baptism as a putting on of new garments. You put off, Paul says, the old man or the old self or the old person, and you put on the new man or the new person, which is renewed in knowledge after him who has created him, which is the Lord Jesus Christ. So the putting on of new garments and the washing and the preparation for the putting on of the new garments is a picture of leaving behind an old way of life, moving to a new way of life. It is a picture of redemption. It is a picture in the New Testament of baptism, the washing and the new clothes. And all of this seems to be wrapped up in what is happening here. This is the story of redemption. And there must be personal cleansing and preparation so as to partake in this redemption. And this is what Naomi is suggesting to Ruth. Now, she tells her a procedure by which she will call to Boaz's attention what his duty might be. And we just heard the story and we're familiar with it. It strikes me as I think about this, and I'm sure it's occurred to some of you, that this is a little suggestive, perhaps. It's a little bit of reaching toward the edge of propriety. Why does Naomi suggest that Ruth take this approach? Why not, in the bold light of day, call Boaz to come over for a cup of coffee or a cup of tea and sit around the table and discuss what his duties are? And I'm not really sure. It might be that in her own way, Naomi is saying this is what will move him to the commitment that he should have thought of already. There may be some element of that in the story. Ruth does what she's told. And in fact, it works out very well. And she receives the commendation from Boaz that all of the village, all of the people know that you are a virtuous woman. But there's some implication in there that this step that she has taken might suggest otherwise. So I'm not sure, if this was the best way to go about it, or it was simply Naomi's way and she thought it might work. But we should realize there is truly nothing improper about what happens on the threshing floor, no matter what the implications might have seemed to others had they observed the situation. And really, that's about all I can say, because I don't know if there's something else that is being suggested here or not. Of course, Boaz would be sleeping on the threshing floor with his grain. He would be fully clothed. I mean, there would be men sleeping all around, maybe each in the place where his grain was being threshed. There would be servants around too, and Boaz had many servants. By custom, a servant would quite often sleep near the feet of his master so that he could be summoned very quickly. So Ruth is being put into this position of servitude and submission when she is told to lie at his feet. At any rate, Ruth listens to the suggestion of Naomi, and she says, "I will do what you said." And there's an echo there of passages, as we have some on the board, Exodus 19 and Exodus 24. "Whatsoever the Lord has said, we will do." This is what the children of Israel said when they were given instructions. Now, Ruth's instructions come from Naomi, somewhat different, but there is this obedience here. And we're left to think that where the nation of Israel said, "We will do certain things," and didn't, then Ruth, the lone Moabitess woman, says, "I will do what you say," and she goes to do it. And it has a good outcome. It is just as one could have hoped. So we're going to continue with the story.
"It was dark as I slipped into the quiet streets of Bethlehem and moved on toward the edge of town. My feet knew the pathway, even if my mind was unsure. As I approached the threshing floor, I could hear Boaz bidding good night to some guests. I remained in the shadows, watching, listening. Then Boaz's chief servant came to see what final task his master might have for him. But Boaz dismissed him for the night, and in just a few minutes he lay down at the end of a pile of grain. I waited anxiously till the last sounds of human life in the area were gone. Sounds of the night were all around. Crickets chirped softly in the warm earth. An owl in a nearby tree hooted repeatedly, and overhead the moon and stars twinkled in a black velvet sky. I could hear Boaz breathing deeply and regularly as he drifted into heavy sleep. Still, I waited. Was there no other way? None, it seemed. I must continue with the plan, and I must continue to believe that all would work out well. Softly, I crept over to him, and with trembling hands, I lifted his blanket and slipped under at his feet. I lay there minute after minute, hour after hour, afraid of a servant coming, afraid to move lest I wake Boaz, and yet knowing that my quest could only be finished if he were awake. I shivered as the warm evening turned to a cooler night. At some point in the night, Boaz stretched and turned in his sleep, and it was at this time that he was suddenly aware of another body near him. He awoke with a start, and as we both sat up, he realized that a woman was with him. All the anxieties of the previous hours were now concentrated on this single moment. Now was the time. I must speak as Naomi instructed me. So now I spoke first to my heavenly Father quickly, and then to Boaz, who had asked, "Who are you?" "I am your servant Ruth. Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer." I heard him gasp. How would I bear the shame of his refusal? Where would I go? How would we live? So many questions flashed through my head. After what seemed like many minutes, he spoke. "The Lord bless you, my daughter. This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask. All my fellow townsmen know that you are a woman of noble character. Although it is true that I am near of kin, there is a kinsman and redeemer nearer than I. Stay here for the night, and in the morning, if he wants to redeem, good, let him redeem. But if he is not willing, as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. Lie here until morning. And so I lay back down at his feet, but sleep was impossible. Was this really true, or was I dreaming? The reality of the grain-covered ground, hard under me, the smell of the threshing floor, and Boaz light breathing nearby assured me that I was awake, and that, yes, I had indeed accomplished my task. Boaz would marry me. But first he had to see if the nearer kinsman wanted to marry me instead. I wondered who that was. What was he like? Did he already have a wife and children? Would he want a Moabite for a wife? Boaz would attend to all the details in the morning, he had said.
Ruth lies down at the feet of Boaz. Echoes there in the New Testament. The woman who was a sinner coming into the house where Jesus was, kneeling at his feet, washing those feet with her tears, saying in effect the same thing that Ruth says, spread the corner of your garment over me. You are my kinsman. Redeem me from my life of sin, from a soul filled with sin. And he forgives her. This request, spread the corner of your garment, literally spread your wing over me, is a request for marriage. It is a request for protection under the shadow of the arms of the strong one, the husband. The casting of an outer garment over the bride's head was a customary ceremony at Middle Eastern marriages. A symbol of the husband offering the wife shelter, manuka, if you will, in his tent or his house. It is really the derivation of the bridal canopy that we see at Jewish weddings and perhaps at some other weddings as well. The canopy overshadowing and protecting. And in a sense, there are two protections in this case. There is the protection of the human husband for his wife. And then there is the protection of the overarching arms of God, the everlasting arms, as Isaiah calls them, of God for his people who are living under his covenant, under his care and protection. This was a typical scene at Middle Eastern weddings. Ezekiel 16 is an interesting chapter. We're not going to try to read it at all. But it's there on the board, and you might want to read it sometime at your leisure. It might occur in one of the other classes for consideration under the marriage of the Lord, or at least some of the concepts will certainly be discussed there. It's an allegory of Israel, or Jerusalem, as being the wife of God. And it starts out with this story where God is speaking of, once you were a little child and you were born and you were left in your blood, almost like an abortion, cast out to die, and no one tended you and no one cared for you, God speaking to Jerusalem, God speaking to Israel as a whole. And I walked by and I saw you in this desperate state, and I made sure that you lived through that time. And you grew up, God says, until finally you were a woman. And I cared for you, and I loved you. And then verse 8, which makes the lovely connection with the book of Ruth. I spread the corner of my garment over you and covered your nakedness. I gave you my solemn oath and entered into a covenant with you, declares the Lord, and you became mine. God taking Israel as his wife into his covenant, the everlasting covenant. Yet, Israel turns their back on him. And as the chapter goes on and on into distasteful detail about the kinds of sins that Israel, that Jerusalem, the wife of God, committed, going after other men, the kings of the earth, and committing fornication under every tree. And God looking after that woman, waiting for her to come back to him, desperately seeking a way by which she might be joined to him again, the one with whom he had made a covenant. And she had violated that covenant. But as we look at the story, in a time of separation of the grain from the chaff, in a time of judgment, the faithful Gentile comes to Boaz, the strong Jew, and asks for protection under the hem of his garment. I want to look at a couple of passages. I want to ponder this for a minute or two. And the first passage is Zechariah 8, verse 23. The Gentile looks for protection under the hem of the garment of the strong one, Boaz, the Jew. Zechariah 8, 23. This is what the Lord Almighty says. In those days, and this is a kingdom prophecy, in those days, 10 men from all languages and nations will take firm hold of one Jew by the hem of his robe and say, let us go with you because we have heard that God is with you. When I was in Sunday school, we used to learn Bible passages. You know, every week you remember one or two Bible passages and you recite them. And this is one of the ones that you learn. And I remember, you know, from the earliest years when I was hearing these things, that there was one exposition of this, which was, and maybe it's different in other places, but which was simply, there is a time coming when the kingdom is set up that the Jews who have been persecuted and reviled and ridiculed by all other peoples will now be seen to be the favored people of God. And 10 men out of all the nations, or Gentile men, will go up to any Jew that they see and will grab hold of him and say, we'll go with you because we know that God is with you. And that's a fine picture. And it could well be true and work out just that way. But what occurred to me as I pondered this passage in light of other passages was there is a much more precise meaning here. The one who is a Jew is Jesus Christ. And men out of all nations are in fact Gentiles. But they come not to any Jew at random. They come to the one strong Jew. And they grab him by the hem of the garment. And they say, we will go with you. They say in effect, we say in effect, every day, spread the corner of your garment over me. Protect me. Provide me a lasting home of security. Forgive my sins. Bind me to you eternally. And all of these things, the marriage language, the ritual and the sense of marriage is being suggested here. And of course, there's a New Testament passage, Mark 5, verses 25 through 34, and I think it's in one of the other Gospels. The woman who was unclean, struggling to make her way through the crowd so that she can get close enough to Jesus just to grab the hem of his garment, just to find a little protection under that garment. And by her faith, she is healed. And there is the enacted parable that we see in Zechariah 8. The hem of the garment is the hem of the garment of the strong one, the true Boaz, Jesus Christ. And as we see in Zechariah 8:23, the last phrase, we will go with you because we have heard that God is with you. That God is with you. Emmanuel. That is the meaning of, that is the Hebrew. We will go with you because you are Emmanuel. You are God who is with us. The overreaching arms of God offering protection are seen in the person, in the flesh, in the life of Jesus Christ. And we will go with you. Boaz says to Ruth, all of the land, all of the people know that you are a virtuous woman. And I know we don't have much time. We still have a few minutes. But I want to look at Proverbs 31. And I alluded to this earlier. Ruth is the virtuous woman. She is the pattern. She is the prototype of the virtuous woman. And you may have to ponder that on your own a bit to see how fitting it is, because we don't have time to go through and look at each verse. But Boaz uses the same expression that is used later in Proverbs 31, verse 10. A woman of noble character it is in the NIV. In the King James Version, a virtuous woman. Ruth was this virtuous woman. The word means something like one who has strong character, one who has purpose and resolve, a virtuous woman, one who is noble, as the NIV puts it, one who will stand firm for what she believes. A wife of noble character, who can find? She is worth far more than rubies. Notice verse 29. Many women do noble things, but you surpass them all. It could almost be the words that Boaz would speak to Ruth. Notice in Proverbs 31, the great wealth of this woman. Verses 13 through 18 is a whole description of all of the products that flow through the house. And then later on, there's a description of the servants that come under the supervision of this virtuous woman. She is the mistress of a large and prosperous house, paying close attention to everything that goes on in the house, the preparation of the food, the clothing, the caring for the crops, the buying and the selling of products, almost like it's a family enterprise, and she is the executive officer. Well, Boaz was a mighty man of wealth, and now we have this interesting little idea that here was Ruth, first of all, the poorest of the poor, a gleaner in the fields, and now she has become the wife of a very wealthy man, watching over all of these possessions. And how is the virtuous woman characterized in Proverbs 31? Characterized by her diligence. Always watching, always working. She could have been sitting in the parlor having tea and cupcakes, but no, she's out watching, supervising, seeing that everything is done correctly in her domain, over which she has control. And go back to that story at the beginning when Boaz sees Ruth in the field. What was it that called her to his attention? The foreman says, she's been working all through the day and barely stopped to take a break. The same diligence that she showed as a poor gleaner in the field is going to be the same diligence that she shows as a rich wife. And why is that? Why is that? Verse 30. Charm is deceptive and beauty is fleeting, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. That was the characteristic that marked her out. So, Boaz says to Ruth, stay here with me for the night. Stay here at my feet. No harm will come to you. Wait till the first light of day, and then you may return home. Don't worry. Lie down here. You will be safe. Ruth, once again, tells her story.
I was just drifting into an exhausted sleep when Boaz gently awakened me. It was near dawn and time for me to leave so no one would see us together. Before I left, he filled my veil with barley to take home to Naomi. And then we parted. Boaz went toward town to attend to our business, and I went home. Naomi was up and waiting. Had she ever gone to sleep? Had she spent an anxious night like I had? As I entered, she eagerly greeted me. How did it go, my daughter? I told her everything. Then she said, wait, my daughter, until you find out what happens, for the man will not rest until the matter is settled today. Thus we sat down to await what this new day would bring, this new day which followed such a strange night for me. Ruth, widow of Mahlon, an Israelite. For me, there was no rest, just waiting. And as we waited, I remembered so many times of waiting in these past years. I had waited daily, hourly for Mahlon's visits. I had waited for a wedding announcement. I had waited for a wedding, for a new home, for a new life, for a child born of new love, new hopes and dreams, a child which had never come. I had waited beside sick beds. I had waited beside the dying. I had waited for prayers to be answered. I had spent so much time waiting. And now I waited again for my future to be decided at a town gate.
She lay at his feet until the morning. Many a faithful Gentile lies asleep at the feet of Jesus, the Boaz, the strong one of the Jews, awaiting the morning of resurrection, when he will go to the gate of the city and claim her as his bride. Boaz gives to Ruth a large quantity of grain for Naomi. It's his way of sending assurance to his kinswoman that he understands the request, that he will do the best he can to see that she and Ruth are protected. And so chapter 3, verse 18 concludes with Naomi's words, "Wait, my daughter, until you find out what happens. The man will not rest until the matter is settled today." Thanks be to God that his son, our Boaz, did not rest until the matter of our redemption was settled. Relieved and happy are we when we hand over our anxieties to the Lord in the certainty that he will care for us. Cast all your care upon him, for he cares for you.